Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello, ho, ho.
Ho, ho, ho.
It may not be that much ho for people on the 20th of December.
Ed was sceptical about this being a festive episode.
You think we go full ho?
I think once we're into the 20s, you can go full ho.
I have a slight disaster to report to you, which is that the compost bin got overfilled and an animal got into it, and I had to sweep it all up this morning.
Oh, Ed.
And those bins are very well designed, though, that if you put the lid on the right way, the handle, you can't open them. They're unopenable by the animals. Anyway, the animal really got to it. And also, I was the first person to see it outside. And so I thought, you know, in normal circumstances, I'd sort of ignored it and left it to Justine to sort of deal with.
Oh, I didn't see that. It must have happened after I left.
Completely banged to rights, I thought. You know, it's just all over. It's like old bits of orange, you know. An animal had really sort of had it
gone to town.
They'd had a party in the food waste.
That's nice for them at this time of year.
Yeah,
a little Christmas party for the animal.
And then I was thinking, if I don't sweep it all up, are we going to get rodents, or, you know, because they'll be attracted to it?
Are you going to start a witch hunt as to who didn't close the bin lid properly?
I think that would be not very Christmassy spirit thing. It could have been me. It was the third. I think it might be the third food waste bag, or maybe it wasn't put out last week.
I would behave gracefully, but inside I would be seething. Unless
might
I knew
be
it was
me, but it might be me. I don't know. I just don't
Then I would be keeping very quiet.
I just don't
it.
Know.
And what are you thinking? Foxes?
Foxes, probably, yeah. Well, I don't want to think beyond foxes.
I wish we had raccoons in this country just to mix it up a bit.
Do you?
As I said last week on the podcast, ever since following this Twitter account, Raccoons Hourly, I've become quite obsessed with them.
I don't want to be anti-raccoons, but we had two... When I lived in America when I was seven, we had two cats. And I think one of them got attacked by a raccoon.
Oh, nasty bastards.
Is that a possibility? I saw a thing about some man being attacked by beavers the other day, quite seriously.
You don't think there's an animal uprising, do you?
I don't know. Anyway, I remember the cats are called Tom and Kutsi. I don't know why they were called, they were their names. And one of them got attacked by a raccoon. At least that's what my mother told me. Maybe that was a made-up story, but...
It survived?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, all's well that ends well. I don't want to slur all raccoons, though.
No, I think
it could have just been one bad apple.
We're a raccoon friendly. We're a raccoon friendly setting here on this podcast. I think we've diverted off Christmas a bit too much, haven't we?
We have.
Are you most looking forward to about in terms of present giving? I'm not in a good. I was ahead of the game, and then I got complacent, and I'm now sort of quite seriously behind the game.
Oh, I'm behind. I'm way behind the game. I haven't even started to think about Sarah's present yet, which
Shit.
Is the tough one. And what are you hoping for?
I bought various clothes items. I bought a shacket.
What is a shacket? Ed is now coming back in. I can hear him. He's entering the frame of the Zoom. Look at this. Oh, so I should have been able to work this out. This is a portmanteau of shirt and jacket.
It's a cross between a shirt and a jacket.
That's really nice.
It is nice, isn't it?
It's very flattering. You're so slender these days. Your clothes just hang off you like a model. You're so willowy.
Well, I don't know about that.
Is that a thing they call a worker jacket?
Yeah, maybe it is a little bit.
Here's who I would imagine wearing this. A top architect in a Parisian firm, or maybe somebody in the design department at Apple. It's very stylish.
You don't think it looks like a sort of somebody on strike in the 1970s outside a brazier with a, you know, outside on a picket line?
You haven't got an oil drum that you could just set on fire so you can stand you next to it. No, I think it's really nice because I think that's a thickness of fabric issue, and it doesn't have anything of that sort of donkey jacket quality to it.
So that's my sort of Christmas present.
Nicely quilted on the inside as well.
Mm, nicely quilted.
From Justine?
I suppose so, yeah, from me to me, I suppose.
What, you're just going to give her the receipt and ask her to reimburse
you? Yeah, it's all a bit fungible, really.
I wish I knew what fungible and non-fungible meant, but maybe that's an episode for the future.
We've got to do an episode on non-fungible tokens. NFTs, don't you think?
I feel like I should know about them, but I don't really
understand.
You know
what they are? I don't really understand them either.
I sort of do, but I sort of don't. It's like before we did anything on Bitcoin or blockchains or crypto.
I really think we should do NFTs at some point. I really do. Yeah. I think it would be quite good.
Yeah. So we're doing an AMA, as we did last year, because we can't have our traditional game of class struggle with friends. We have been asking you for your questions on social media, and we're going to barrel through as many as we can. Before we do so, do you have a festive reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is my family.
Aww.
Justine and the children.
I do like them. They do reflect very well on you.
Aww. You know, one gets so consumed by work and all of the other stuff that, you know, it's too easy to sort of take for granted, not spend the time and all of that. So Justine, Daniel and Sam are my reasons to be cheerful.
Can you see that I've teared up? I'm so pathetic. Aww. I'm so easily moved to tears. That's lovely, Ed.
Now, the other thing is you've now got a problem, because if you don't say Sarah and Jean, then it's going to be, if you say it's my new pet hamster, then you're going to be in the doo-doo here.
Yeah. I mean, it is a good job that I don't have a pet hamster, because it would easily leapfrog them. Yeah. Your leapfrogging hamster.
Well, take it as read that it's Sarah and Jean, okay?
Yeah, okay. It's Sarah and Jean. Yeah, funny old year. Once I go, it's very difficult to come.
I'm sorry.
Once I go, it's very difficult to come back.
I'm
from.
I'm sorry. I know
you're
thinking about your mum. I know.
Yeah, but my mum was one of these people who loved Christmas, but not like a grown up loves Christmas. And some people, as adults, really get into like loads of Christmas decorations and jumpers and all that stuff. My mum, in a completely and typically unshowy way, really loved Christmas through a child's eyes. And I feel dead lucky that Jean is, you know, 5 and a half this Christmas, and that I get to see that, and it's brilliant. So there you go. Yeah, I'll have you painted me into the corner, but I'll have that as well.
And I think that's a really important point, which I think in a way you are very good at doing, and I'm not so good at doing, because my children really love Christmas. And at one point there was a sort of prospect of us being away for Christmas Day, and they were really not very keen on being away, because they just, you know, there's a sort of certain Christmas traditions, and I think it is, well, I really like that idea that you've got to see it through a child's eyes.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
All right, here we go. Are you ready for me to delve into my big Santa sack and get the first question?
Yes, I'm all ears.
Here we go. This comes from Anna Redmond.
Yeah.
Who uses a very big heart emoji, which I particularly enjoy. What is your most used emoji, by the way?
I think it might be the sort of, maybe it's the crying one, you know, the full tears of laughter type one.
I'm glad it's tears of laughter.
Yeah.
Your face suggested it might be the kind of Wallace and Gromacy.
Well, it is partly that one too.
The grimacy one. Yeah, that is a good one.
The grimacy one. What's your favourite?
I've become increasingly attached to the cowboy hat one.
What does that indicate?
I think I just like to use it because it's one of the lesser used emoji.
What does it mean, the cowboy hat?
I just think it's a fun face to send to somebody.
I'm not really an expert on emojis. And what do we think about emojis in general?
I held out for a long time. I refused to use them, and then I just saw it was the way the world was going, and I've tried to give in.
When did they get invented, emojis?
I'm not sure, but I can tell you something interesting about them if you want.
I'm not sure you can, but go on.
There is a consortium. I think it's called the Unicode Consortium that convenes in Switzerland every year to decide what, if any, new emojis they're going to introduce.
If Labour gets into government, I'm going to try and become responsible for emojis, and I'll nominate you to the committee. Climate change, net zero, and emojis.
Some people crave being the ambassador.
To emojis.
Yeah, I'd really like to be the ambassador to emojis.
Yeah, we've sort of slightly got diverted, I think.
Anna says, a listener recently suggested that the Jeffocracy changes its name to Jefftopia. I would like to suggest that the ocracy part is less of an issue than the Jeff part, since we are interested in ideas, not personalities. Could you consider changing to the Cheerfulocracy or maybe the Reasonsocracy? So my initial reaction is that I would...
No, your initial reaction is no.
I would feel sad to have to take all the statues down and change the banknotes. But I just want to point out, and I've tried to get this point over the line a few times recently.
Ed invented the Jeffocracy. It was your creation. I mean, honestly, it's like, you know, I just don't buy this, really.
It's there. It's on one of the early episodes.
I know, but the point is, you know, you could have said, no, I'm not into the cult of personality.
What was Tony Benn's line?
It's policies, not personalities. you could easily have sort of said no.
I could, but when the mantle of power was thrust upon me by you in such a way...
Do you know the Sherman Oath?
No, tell me.
The Sherman Oath is, if nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. And now, who was Sherman? That's the question. It's what people say when they refuse to run for something. Let's just look. Sherman Oath origins. Here we are. It's American political jargon for a clear and direct statement by a potential candidate indicating he or she will not run for a particular elected position. The term derives from the Sherman Pledge, a remark made by American Civil War General William Tecumseh Sherman when he was being considered as a possible Republican candidate for the U.S. presidential election of 1884. He declined, saying, "I will not accept if nominated and will not serve if elected." Interesting, eh?
I feel a certain kinship with William Sherman.
I was thinking you might take the Sherman Oath when it comes to going to parties. If invited, I will not come. And if dragged there by my wife, I will refuse. I mean, there must be a sort of... There must be a kind of version. There must be a version of it. So hang on. But this is my point. We're wandering here. The point I put about the Jeffocracy is you could have invoked the Sherman Oath.
I only just found out about it.
Ah.
I'm going to retrospectively invoke the Sherman Oath.
No, but we quite like the Jeffocracy, to be honest. I mean, there is a certain absurdity about it, and I'm not talking about the ocracy part.
I don't see it. I don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, if it was a serious concept, it would be very scary.
You mean
the Jeff Tony, part, yeah. The Tony Benn thing,
that how did you get the power and how do we get rid of you?
No, I would quite like to live in a world ruled by you. I think it would be a much nicer world.
There'd be, as I said many times, there would be a lot of delegation, but I think my heart would be in the right place.
Your heart definitely would be in the right place. And I think you're sort of, I think you're slightly too self-deprecating. I think after 200 and something episodes, you've gone through the training course. I mean, the Jeffocracy around episode 5, I think it would have had a few challenges. I think it would have been a sort of slightly kind of bumpy ride. But yeah. I think by now you've got your sort of MA in cheerful studies.
Yes.
Yeah, well on the way to the PhD.
The manifesto is a lot more fleshed out. Back then I was seeing a lot of parades back then, but now I'm a lot more focused on the ideas and the policies.
You're much less focused on sort of parades of tanks going up and down the street with you saluting, aren't you? Yeah, I think you do the right, you know, you've got models of leadership to learn from. You've heard the war stories about Gordon and, you know, the things to emulate, the things maybe not to emulate.
Oh, you've persuaded me, Ed. Let's keep the Jeffocracy.
Let's keep it. Sorry.
Bring on the Jeffocracy.
Sorry to our listener, but we're keeping it.
Joel Corner.
Ah, the Milliverse.
Joel was on our Christmas party a few years ago, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Joel says, this is for Ed. I loved Go Big, especially the chapter on devolution. I was wondering what kind of devolution you think is most likely to happen in England. Would it be devolved regional parliaments, more mayors, more powers for mayors, or something else?
Well, funnily enough, talking of Gordon Brown, we've got a report coming from Gordon Brown, I think sometime next year, because he's been looking at Scottish, for the Labour Party, he's been looking at Scottish devolution, but also wider devolution issues in England too. I suppose the truth is I'm not particularly kind of dug in on a particular form of it. I think the thing I talk about in the book is that at the moment it's incredibly piecemeal. So I was in Norwich last week.
For the quiz of the week?
What?
I forget you didn't watch ITV when you were growing up. It was the Sale of the Century. It was live from Norwich. It's the quiz of the week.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
live from Norwich. It's the quiz of the week. Sale of the Century. No? Anglia TV, the little silver knight going round on a rotating plinth at the beginning.
Hmm. So you see, South Yorkshire, where I'm an MP, has a mayor. but that mayor at the moment has significantly less powers than Greater Manchester. Norwich doesn't have a kind of an elected sort of metro mayor or equivalent for the wider area. So it's all incredibly sort of messed up and sort of piecemeal. At the moment, it's been a very centrally managed process of devolution where Westminster has given bits away. So I think that's the first thing. The second thing, it's got to have real power and real resources, I think. You know, I keep saying this thing about how Andy Burnham can try and regulate the buses, but if he wants to run his own bus company, he can't. I actually think devolution is one of the issues where, you know, I was sort of convinced of it as a local MP, but I think doing the podcast has sort of convinced me of it more. And it is about people's control over the things that matter to them, I think, fundamentally.
After we've been doing the podcast a while, I don't know, maybe even only sort of 10 or 20 episodes, themes started to emerge that were common to a lot of the ideas. And one of them is that in this country, power's too centralised. And a lot of these policies could really flourish if some of that power was devolved.
Yeah, we're into that. We're definitely, and also, we're just so unusual in the amount of centralisation we have.
I'd quite like to be a mayor, but not one of the ones like Andy Burnham, where you really have to do very much. I'd like to be one of those ceremonial mayors where you get to wear a big gold chain, like Mr. T.
Civic mayor.
Yeah.
It generally is people who are a councillor. People start off as a councillor where they have to do real work, and then... by the way, being a civic mayor is a lot of work.
Oh, then I've really misunderstood it. I want to wear the big cloak and the
I know,
the
but
chain
you've got to go to lots and lots and lots of events.
And a tricorn. Oh, yeah. Yeah, tricorn hat. Yeah, I'd not really thought about the socialising aspect of it.
Could you be a consort? Maybe there's a civic mayor who's listening who needs a consort.
Do I have to be romantically involved with them?
I don't think so, no.
Oh, then maybe not. Joel also adds for Jeff, have you managed to get Ed to watch all of Get Back yet? I'm going to be honest here. I've invited him for a sleepover. I have hired at some expense Sergeant Pepper costumes. And yet you keep finding reasons purportedly to do with your family and your important job to decline my invitation.
You know what? It's interesting this. I've got news to report on this front, which is I did start watching it. I tried to persuade my wife to watch it last Saturday night. I mean, it is really interesting. It's amazing footage. I think you have to maybe know the backstory a bit more. She didn't seem that interested. Okay, this is slightly blaming her. But so I started watching it for 15 minutes, like, oh, this is amazing. And then she was looking at her phone. And so it sort of slightly put me off.
When you put these films on, you need to switch into slow TV mode.
Yeah.
It's not a pacey...
Yeah.
Documentary. It's a feat of storytelling.
Yeah.
And an exploration into the psychodrama of friendship and bands and creativity told over nearly 8 hours. And the period it covers is a 3-week period pretty much. So you need to adapt to that. And it's almost like I think you can have it on in the way that you'd have a goldfish bowl in the corner of your room and you can drift in and out of it. I think that's I've had a lot of people who aren't big fans like I am who've wanted to talk to me about it. And I think that's the key.
Can I ask you, and forgive me if my amnesia is just we've already discussed this. I read a really interesting piece, which I think I might have sent you in the New York Times, about Yoko's role in this.
Yeah.
I mean, Yoko's role in the documentary.
Yes.
That it's very, very, and it's a very interesting sort of study of, well, her studied approach to this.
Yeah.
You know, that she's sitting there reading the newspaper, doing other things.
Like, what's interesting is the way that story has been told of the end of the Beatles for decades.
Has been blaming her, basically.
There's been a lot of implication the weirdness of having her around was ultimately a disruptive force. And what you see, actually, is she just quietly gets on with doing what she's doing. I think historically there's been a lot of misogyny and probably a bit of racism in the way right. that people thought about her. Back then it was a rock star's girlfriend putting herself where you know, a certain type of man would have thought she didn't belong. But it is interesting watching how accommodating the Beatles are. And I'm not saying they always were of her, but by this stage they'd accepted that that was how John and Yoko wanted to be, and they were figuring out how to incorporate that in a really reasonable and emotionally intelligent way.
Yeah.
Okay, you ready for another one?
Yep.
Let me delve into... Oh, it's a selection box now. It's not a Santa sack. In the selection box, this comes from Jan Clifford Godfrey on Facebook.
Raspberry cream.
Is that your preferred?
Not really. It's the one I thought of, though.
Do you have a box of chocolates in the house at Christmas? Do you go for a tub?
Well, you know, my older son doesn't like chocolate, so it's slightly confusing.
When did that happen?
He's never liked chocolate.
What a blessing that is.
I know.
So Jan says, oh, this is on a food topic as well. What would Ed have on his sandwich in his make-your-own sandwich bar? I can't believe we've gone this many episodes and that hasn't
good
come up.
Good question.
Yeah. So you're making a sandwich today, Ed. What's going on to it? What bread are you using?
These are all difficult questions. My bluff has been well and truly called here, hasn't it? I've been going on and on and on, wanging on about this make-your-own-sandwich thing. It's like, okay, well, what sandwich would you like?
Yeah.
You go first.
Okay. Let me just calibrate here. Here's what I'm going to have. I'm going to have like a spongy white bread. Is it going to be a sourdough?
Well.
Maybe it is going to be a sourdough. My son the other day, we were in a local shop, and he went, Daddy, I want some sourdough. And I just thought, what kind of North London middle class
exactly.
cliche have I become? How does he even know the word sourdough? That hasn't come from me.
Yeah.
So maybe a nice spongy white sourdough. Then what I'm going to do is fry up some tofu.
Wow.
Sliced tofu. And I'm going to put some crunchy iceberg lettuce into the sandwich.
Oh, this is good. Sounding good, actually.
Yeah, it's going to have vegan mayonnaise mixed
cheese,
with...
Vegan cheese? No
vegan cheese.
No,
mixed with...
The kit's out of date.
I know what you're driving at.
Yeah.
It expired, sadly.
Birthday, Christmas present?
Yeah.
On the scrap heap, keep going.
It's going to have vegan mayonnaise mixed in with chipotle paste to give it a bit of spice.
Yeah.
And then some sun-dried tomatoes. I think this might be inspired by a sandwich from one of Anna Jones's cookbooks, but that's my sandwich.
And is the tofu is the sort of staple?
I think the tofu and the spice is the thing, and then you get the crunch from the lettuce and just a bit of a tingy top note from the sun-dried tomato.
You've set a high bar and I'm finding myself really struggling here.
But I think a simple sandwich can be very good as well.
I think sort of if there's no guilt attached.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm also sort of now thinking, should it be vegetarian? Should it be vegan?
No judgment.
You see, I used to have, perhaps notoriously, sandwiches with meat in them, but not because of the incident, but just more generally. I sort of don't really eat. So, like, I used to really like salami or ham type sandwiches, but I don't really eat those things anymore for a whole range of health reasons.
Are there any sandwiches when you think of your childhood, you get like a Proustian rush? Maybe when you lived in America, are there any sort of classic American sandwiches, like those deli sandwiches?
That had a sort of goop problem. Not Gwyneth Paltrow, but, that is part of my reason for the make-your-own sandwiches. I always found that a lot of those American sandwiches, there was just, too much goop. Anyway, look, I'm havering here. So I think... I tell you what I quite like is just a very plain cheese sandwich on brown bread with just a very small amount of butter.
Nice.
A simple cheese sandwich.
Like what you'd give to a child when you go to a museum.
It's exactly right. I don't know why you said that, but that is exactly right.
Whenever you go to places like the Natural History Museum, they have these boxes and they have
that
very,
is
very
exactly
simple...
what I like. I think that is exactly the sandwich I like. That's really the inspiration for making a sandwich. No goop, no messing around.
There's not even going to be a slice of tomato on there.
There could be a slice of, possibly a slice of tomato. I think there's also, we mustn't sort of, I think we need to give some coverage to our bagel friends here.
Mm.
So a sort of a poppy seed bagel with some cream cheese and some smoked salmon. And some lemon and some black pepper and maybe a pickle on the side. I think if we talked about pickles before, I've got a vague memory we have.
Sarah's a huge fan. She can devour a jar. She can inhale a jar within minutes.
I think we should make 2022 the year of the pickle. I mean, I think they have been very... I think they are... gherkins are undersold.
We love an underdog on this podcast.
Do you think we can get data on... Oh, I've got a data question for our listeners, by the way. Do you think we can get data on pickle consumption?
We can get someone on it.
Over time. But people don't talk about pickles, really.
They
Is it an American thing, the pickle? Do you have a jar of pickles in the house?
We do, because Sarah's American. But when I was growing up, we'd have a jar of pickled onions on the table with Sunday lunch.
Pickled onions? Well, the pickled onions are a completely different kettle of
no,
fish.
No, I know. But I don't
like pickled onions. I'm not very keen.
I think that's a very northern thing. So pickled beetroot, pickled onions.
I think pickled beetroot's all right. But a beetroot is also an underrated vegetable. Anyway, the question I was going to ask about the science is, I've got quite obsessed, as you know, with cold water swimming. And... The temperatures plunge to 4, so I've equaled my PB, my personal best, in swimming in 4. Now the temperature's gone back up to 6, but that got me thinking, which is there's a time series of the temperatures in the ponds going back 10 years. It must be possible to know the outside air temperature over those 10 years. Could someone plot the relationship between the two of them? Could one of our listeners, this is an appeal to the listeners, to plot the relationship so that it will give me a sense, as I look at the forecast going forward, that means that the pond temperature is going up. Basically, the water temperature, I think, is a lagging indicator. It lags behind the air temperature.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't just sort of immediately kind of change. But I don't quite fully understand the relationship.
So air temperature, or at least the what it feels like in the air, can be affected by factors like wind. What are the factors that affect water temperature apart from sunlight and heat on the water?
Well, I don't know. I mean, the outside air temperature, obviously. But it doesn't, you know, when the outside air temperature is 2, it doesn't immediately go to 2, the ponds. It's sort of, and there's some complicated thing about the, is it the warmer water is at the top and the colder water is at the bottom and there's some heat transference that goes on? I don't quite fully know. So you'll have more warmth in the water as you get into winter than the outside air temperature would suggest, but then it'll be colder, I think, as you come out of it in the spring. It will lag behind, is my guess. But I'd like...
Well, that's why September's often a good month for water temperature, if you like it warm, because it's had the whole summer to heat up.
And actually, you know, we might be going to Cornwall, assuming we're allowed, assume we will be, for after Christmas. And I was looking at the sea temperature. And by the way, it's quite interesting. We're hopefully going on holiday to a lighthouse where there's no Wi-Fi and no phone signal, as I understand it. And there's a foghorn that goes off in the middle of the night if it's foggy.
That sounds like a harmonious family holiday.
It's getting away from it all. Anyway, this is a sort of an appeal. There must be tech-savvy listeners who could plot these two things on a graph. And I'd just like to know what the relationship is.
When you get into the water, do you do it slowly or quickly?
Well, I don't dive in. I think I can't imagine doing that. I go in slowly. By the way, I mean, as you know, I could bore on about cold water swimming for a long time. I mean, honestly, the heron... The bird life in the ponds at the moment has been amazing. You know, you see a heron passing by.
And have you got to a stage where you're like St. Francis of Assisi, where they come to you?
The herons.
Yeah.
But they stay very close. They seem very, very unperturbed by humans.
What about you in particular, though? Have you got a particular kinship and affinity with this heron?
No, although somebody did accuse me of slightly showing off as I did my third lap in 5 degrees the other day. I was bashful about it. I said, oh, you know, suppose I've got these socks and gloves and so on.
Were you hoping somebody had noticed that you did 3 laps?
Definitely.
Well, let's see if we get any data back from our listeners on this air temperature, water temperature correlation thing. This comes from Katie and Jamie in Bath. They add not in the bath.
Yeah.
Because that would have sparked a whole conversation about who gets the tap end. It says, loved seeing Ed in the COP26 Jonathan Pye film.
Mm.
Would you have Jonathan Pye as either A, the next Prime Minister, or B, BBC News anchor? Now, we know that you can't opt for A because it would become a headline. So what do you think about the prospect of Jonathan Pye becoming a BBC anchor?
Well, it was one of many interviews I did at COP26. He said the conceit was that he was hoping to interview Barack Obama and he ended up with me. And so I said I thought I was ending up with Wolf Blitzer, and I ended up with him.
That's good.
Yeah, it wasn't bad. I thought of it on the spur of the moment. Not too shabby.
In terms of interviewers,
yeah,
I'm not asking you to play favourites, but yeah. Is there anybody who, I'm not saying they give you an easy ride, but you go and you think, okay, this is going to be engaging and it's going to be a fun mental and verbal workout. And is there anybody who you can't sleep the night before they interview you?
I tell you who I quite admire as an interviewer, although I think it's sort of probably prejudicial for him, is Evan Davis on the PM programme. Do you know the PM programme?
Yeah.
That's not to say that he doesn't ask tough questions. He absolutely does. But I think he is on a sort of mission to... When I have been interviewed by him, I tend to think he's on a mission to explain. He's quite cerebral. And he sort of tries to kind of think, okay, what's the deeper truth here?
It's good when there's that kind of curiosity underpinning it rather than... obviously you've got to hold people's feet to the fire if you're doing that job. But this obsession... With pinning somebody down to a one-word yes-no answer on something to score a point. I can't listen to that stuff anymore.
Funnily enough, the other person I get on well with, I have a good relationship with is Nick. Do you know Nick Ferrari on LBC?
Yeah, you always seem to have fun when I see you on that
show. Yeah, I do have fun with him.
So what is it you like about going on there?
I don't know. We have sort of banter. Bants.
Bit of chemistry.
Bants.
Bants in your pants.
I think it's quite good if you... a politician, if you can feel relaxed enough that, and again, he asks really difficult questions, but it's more that you can just have a kind of slightly funny exchange. I think it began when he asked me about Honest Ed's and electric cars. If Honest Ed was trying to sell me an electric car, I began my life as sort of writing TV interviews.
Did you?
Well, I was a researcher on A Week in Politics.
Who was the host?
Andrew Rawnsley and Vincent Hanna. Vincent Hanna, who is a very sort of eminent TV presenter. He was Mr. By-Elections at one point in the 1980s. He would report on by-elections. And that's where I met Harriet Harman. We did a very, very tough interview with her when she was Chief Secretary to the Treasury, which sort of went quite badly for her. Anyway, I met her through that and then sort of went to work for her.
And she still went to work for her after that interview, which, did you tell her you'd written the questions?
Yeah, I think she kind of wanted me on side. And actually, we should mention Harriet because she's actually standing down from Parliament last week. And, I think it's quite a sad moment, but also a moment to really... I said to her, I mean, I think it's really interesting that, you know, she is a conviction politician. She has advanced the cause of gender equality above all with passion, determination... against massive obstacles. And I think it's really interesting that if you look over the sweep of somebody's career, you know, every politician has their sort of ups and downs, and she's had her share of them. Sacked from the cabinet, all kinds of other things, you know, by Tony Blair, etc., etc. But, you know, people have, I think, quite a lot of respect for her and her commitment to the cause.
God, I'd love to get her on one time.
We should get her on. Let's ask her.
I also like it when people know... when it's time to leave the party. I don't mean political party.
Is that aimed at me?
No, but...
Okay, sunshine. I get the message.
Yeah. I've been trying to convene the men in grey suits to come and give you a tap on the shoulder. I think you could be like the Dennis Skinner.
MoveOn.org.
All right, straight back into the selection box. This comes from Lizzie Cook on Facebook, who says... who would win if the cabinet and the shadow cabinet had a royal rumble, and why? So this is interesting. So, like the Sharks and the Jets.
What is a royal rumble?
I think it's a street fight. Have you seen the film Anchorman?
Is that Ron Burgundy?
Yeah. Now this is we're going to live this out in the mind. I know you're a lover, not a fighter. I know that you would never condone this kind of thing, but I would say that Rob is the one to avoid. And I thought the three people you could take, the only three people, in fact, are Gove, Little Rishi, and Simon Clark. I saw a fellow called Chief Secretary to the Treasury, and I thought you could probably beat him if you went man-o-man.
Okay, can we sort of dial it down here because I'm an anti-violence person. What about sort of celebrity instant knockout?
Okay.
Don't you think that's a sort of easier...
Yeah, let's just to make it a bit easier for you. There are dirigibles involved.
What's dirigibles?
Weren't they the big inflatable things they had on Instant Knockout? Yeah. In my mind, it was a lot of jousting with inflatables and trying to stay on top of things.
I think it's got comic potential.
I think so. I'd stay away from Reese Mogg as well. He looks like he could be a biter.
I'm not playing.
Email us reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter @cheerfulpodcast or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, this comes from Elizabeth, who says, I've learned so much from Reason to be Cheerful. Aww. And have a number of standout episodes that helped raise my awareness and change the way I look at issues, episodes on social care, Black Lives Matter, city planning in particular. Which episodes of Reasons to be Cheerful have been most life-changing for you in the way that you think about an issue?
Ooh, good question.
I think our answer, which we've given a lot in terms of something that neither of us had given much thought to, had been the deliberative democracy sortition and... I guess that type of involving the public in decision-making, which has come up time and time again. I think there's been loads for me because I think this is a harder question for you in a way because you live in this world. So a lot of these ideas are things that will have come across your radar anyway. But I remember when we did the neurodiversity episode, it was a way of thinking about
that's a really good one
and how we're wired that I hadn't given much thought to, and it's something I give a lot of thought to now, and I'm quite passionate about. I really enjoyed framing, which we went into it. I thought, oh, this is just like spin. Basically, we're doing an episode on spin, and I now think a lot about how an issue is presented to the public so they can make a smart decision. Also, I think on the podcast loads of times I've talked about how I was quite glib about big tech and data because I always felt like, oh, I'm getting to be on these social networks all day or whatever. My data is a price that I think is worth paying. And over time, I've just come to realize how much privilege there was in that assumption and what a Pandora's box big tech is.
That's a great list, if I may say so. What do I think? Partly because the First They Ignore You series is very much in my mind. I think forcing oneself to think about the history of ideas and how they come about has been really important to me from the podcast. I think raising one's sights to other countries. You know, I kind of knew about Scandinavia and all the great things they did. But for example, this whole father's leave thing. It's sort of use it or lose it, father's leave. But I'll just say in that context, I think I really enjoyed our Reasons to be Welsh episode. You know, I think Wales has come up quite a lot. Innovative thinking in Wales has come up quite a lot this year on the podcast, actually. Don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. Although both Wales and Scandinavia raise an interesting question, which is when the political consensus of a country means that a government will tend to be one side or the other over a number of years with occasional swings, you can think long term in a way that you can't necessarily
if it's flip-flopping. Yeah, that's interesting. But I think we should say at this point, we really want to hear from listeners, don't we? We want to sort of stir the hornet's nest of our listeners here. Not that they're hornets, but you know what a general picture.
You're coming across as a bit anti-hornet there.
God. Some of my best insects are hornets. you know, it'd be really good to hear from listeners, cheerfulpodcast.com, about what the episodes that, you know, we've got our top 10 next week. our top 10 of the year, but we'd really like to hear from people, wouldn't we?
What do you want from us next? It's been an interesting diversion getting into the history of change over the past few weeks, but are there things that you would like us to focus on? Are there things that we've never touched that you've been thinking, well, it's about time they got around to that?
Yeah, I want to do more climate. I think I'd like to do more of the history, more of the sort of more of the kind of nuts and bolts of how change happens. What are the factors, what are the circumstances that enable change to happen, I think is really interesting. And more cold water swimming.
This comes from Dr. Annette Bramley on Twitter, who says, will we ever get to hear the leisure centre story? I'm taking that to the grave with me. Listen, I'm going to be absolutely honest about what happened. I had a minor story that was relevant to... Don't behave like you're in the House of Commons.
That was a drum roll. No, it was a drum roll.
Oh, I thought you were doing that thing that MPs do when somebody gets to speak that they don't like, so they start banging and... Okay. I had a minor story about a vending machine at the leisure centre that was relevant to the story. And then Ed started being really...
Arsy
and sarcastic, said, oh, is this going to be a good story? Oh, I bet this is going to be interesting. This sounds enthralling. And I thought, well... I'm not going to reward that behaviour. I'm going to keep it to myself.
I've let myself down. I've let the class down.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got some suppressed videos that we've also got to deal with at some point. The geothermal baths is obviously one big one.
Beautiful moment.
What are the other ones? Is there a trampoline video?
There's you on a trampoline, which I have yet to see.
There's me in my cold water swimming gear.
Yes.
Which is definitely not for the faint-hearted. Well, anyway, I don't think we're not going to hear the end of the Leisure Centre story, at least not for some time.
Just to try and make things more comfortable, this comes from Trudy on Twitter, who says, friendship question.
Oh.
What are your
favourite
personality traits of the other person?
Oh, that's a good one. Should we end on this one?
Sure. She also adds, and for an optional extra, least favourite traits.
Reverse order,
so we're ending on a positive.
Oh, God, but I think I'm going to feel offended and you're going to feel offended. Do we want to do the least favourite personality traits?
Because then it might...
It's sort of slightly like, you know, you get 10 people saying nice things on Twitter and one person saying something horrible, and then you spend the whole day thinking about the one person who says something horrible.
Yeah, you make a good point.
Well, maybe you need to find the least attractive personality trait, but which has a sort of good side to it, if you see what I mean. So... Ed can ring me all hours of the day or night, but that's because
he's
he works
so passionate
really hard.
About our friendship and the podcast.
Yeah, or something.
Okay, I've got one.
Yeah.
Ed is so respectful of boundaries and really likes to give my own space that he very thoughtfully will sometimes go days before replying to a text message.
I know. This is a long-term problem. I'm just sort of slightly kind of...
This sounds like you're sitting on some dynamite that you don't want to blow up in my face.
What do you mean?
It sounds like you have something in your back pocket about me that is going to upset me so much that it's going to affect
our
friendship.
No, I can't think of anything.
I am quite bland.
You're not bland.
I mean, so it's difficult to think of anything.
No, it's
too
not
much
bland. I tell you what, I don't think this is unattractive, but I think it sort of... Sometimes, as this was less true when now, sometimes I find you're incredibly nice to so many people, I find, and incredibly solicitous, and then somebody you'll take against, and I find it and it kind of slightly hits me in the eyes, because I'm like, oh my goodness, Jeff's feeling upset with that person. He really doesn't like that person. And it's it's really unusual, because you're not somebody who takes against very many people at all. So when it happens, I find it quite sort of shocking in a way.
Yeah, I've got a list.
And it sort of is a little bit true, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. And I can hold a grudge. I can perceive a slight, I think, at an Olympic level.
Now, should we do the positives?
Yes.
I'll start with you. I think you're incredibly generous. And I mean generous in a sort of broad sense. I mean generous with presents, generous with your time, generous with your love, generous with your sort of concern for people. I think that's the first thing I would say. Secondly, and this is slightly different from generous, I think you're very thoughtful about people, actually, and what other people are feeling. So I think you're quite on the lookout for other people. And I mean, I don't mean on the lookout in a bad way. The dry cleaners story has a sort of certain, for those who were listening last week, has a certain truth to it. You're worried about what other people are going to feel. And I, from quite an early age, I had the same thing. I don't want people to be upset or feel bad. And so, and then I think, I mean, you are very funny. And I think the reason that when the very first episode we, the interview we did was, you know, I was on in this sort of paranoid state of leadership. And I was thinking, okay, who the hell is this guy? And why am I being interviewed by him? And it's all going to go wrong.
I was at this point somebody who'd had a long multi-decade career on national radio. You make it sound like I'd won a competition to interview.
I'm so, oh God, this is terrible. I don't mean who is this guy. Sorry. Okay, I fucked up here. I knew who you were, but I was like, what's he going to be? You know, I wouldn't have thought of you as doing normal political interviews. You certainly hadn't interviewed me before. I screwed up, didn't I? Sorry.
No, not at all. Not at all. Oh, my goodness. I mean, what that's done for my self-esteem.
Well, I sort of, I know, but it was all going fine until the end.
It's so weird because I think I would, like, use very, very similar... I'd choose very similar things. I think, like, yeah, you're incredibly empathetic. For somebody in your job, like, I think often if you do that type of job, you then lose that a little bit. And it's really easy to become narcissistic. And I don't think you have that to you. You're introspective. But I think... but you are... To have done a job where people make a fuss of you for such a long time and then to still be that considerate of other people's feelings, I think is quite unusual. So that empathy is number one. I can't remember who the quote's by. I think it's W.H. Auden, but it's about when you look at your friends and the thing that they've got in common is that they make you laugh. You're really funny and I think people hear that on the podcast and think it's part of the thing that people like about the podcast is they get to see this different side of you. And I think there's a real emotional intelligence to being able to laugh at everything and see the ridiculousness of everything at the same time as still caring about it. And that's certainly true of you. And then maybe more than anything, like your tolerance for cold water. I mean, a lot of people would only be able to do two laps at 4 degrees, but the fact that you can do three
and so humble about it as well.
Yeah,
your humility. And never boasting, always exactly. Sort of hiding my light under a bushel. That's very generous.
Do you think our friendship can ever recover from that level of earnestness?
It was quite earnest, wasn't it? I basically, the way I screwed up was by saying three. The minute I said three, I thought, oh no, this is gonna run and run now because you can't like list them like a sort of shopping list. You've got to sort of go into them in some level of detail, otherwise it looks perfunctory. I mean, thank goodness I didn't say five.
Yeah. Oh, well, what a beautiful Christmas moment we've given people to end on there.
Maybe that's a good thing for other people to think about. You know, when you're sitting around for Christmas or seeing people on at Christmas, you know, maybe you need to think three nice things to say about each other.
Do you think it would make it weird, though? Because I've tried something like that socially once, and there's something odd about it. I don't know if it's a
Why?
British thing or not. Because there is there's a discomfort that can come with earnestness. And do you remember we did an episode which had this element in it that you'd done on your community leadership course?
Oh, yeah.
Where you kind of talk about your values. And do you remember I found it incredibly difficult to sort of talk in what I felt was a self-serious way?
And why is that? Do you think it's because a lot of human interaction is conducted on a level of fundamental superficiality is not it's not quite the thing I mean, but sort of... We find honesty quite difficult.
Yeah, and I think almost people are so scared that if they get into it in that way, then there's no coming back.
So this article, and this is going to sound strange, if I mentioned this article to you before, it's basically an article I've written, and I've been meaning to contact this chap, this guy, the publisher of the London Review of Books, I think he may no longer be the publisher, Nicholas Spice, wrote this review of an edited volume by Adam Phillips, who I think is a psychotherapist.
Have I mentioned this? You have mentioned it before, yeah.
Have I mentioned it on the podcast?
I'm not sure if you have or not.
One of the many scandalous realities we choose to ignore because we cannot assimilate it is the fact of unexpressed thought. Consider it. Next time you're sitting at dinner with friends or people you don't know, stop for a moment and listen out for the inaudible murmur of concealed thoughts. The things going through your head that you are not speaking, the things going through the heads of the others. On the bus, in a tube carriage filled with silent strangers, at the breakfast table with your loved ones, in the office or the pub. Remember how the secret thoughts are swarming, seething, chattering like millions of bats in an underground cave, rustling beneath the surface of the day like cockroaches. Now and again, unintentionally or by chance, the secret thoughts slip out. You have guests staying, nice, kind, ingenious and well-meaning people who are rather boring. They have left the room and without thinking, you blurt out too loudly to your partner, God, what bores they are. Then you see that the window is open and you realise they're in the room above you and they will have their window open too because it's summer and they'll almost certainly have heard you and they're staying for another 3 days. Now, actually, I think that is sort of, that last bit is a sort of slightly different, but is he onto something?
Oh, yeah. I mean, firstly, what a piece of writing. That's some great writing right there. But
can I tell you the last bit of it? Because this is the paragraph which is just absolutely brilliant. The best bit of writing, I think, is this last, very last sentence, because he then contrasts psychoanalysis and therapy and all that with what went before. And he says, psychoanalysis does something altogether breathtaking. Out of the unworkability of its own project, and as though to upbraid us with the comfortable dishonesty of our ordinary human bonds, it fashions an image of pure trust, not trust based on the appetitive deal-making of friendship and love, but a groundless, purposeless, unjustifiable trust, and this is the line I love, between two human beings holding a conversation on the edge of the abyss.
Whoa, that's so good.
What is the lesson of this, then? That we should be more honest?
I know people who are like, well, I just tell it like it is, and if people can't handle that, then that's their problem. And they're often, I think, quite insensitive people who aren't worried about saying blunt things that will hurt people's feelings. But that's kind of the point, isn't it? So we've all got our own baggage that we bring to every interaction, and you don't know what the other person is. And in a sense, the politeness or the consideration in what we say is trying to factor in what baggage somebody might or might not have.
Well, this is why therapy has sort of got its upside, doesn't it? Because, I mean, it's not even true, but you're nearer to not caring what your therapist thinks.
I do think I'm his favourite, though.
I'm sure you are.
Well, this got deep. It got
really deep.
I think we were those two human beings on the edge of the abyss. A lovely festive abyss. Well, I hope you have a wonderful Christmas.
I hope you have a wonderful Christmas. I hope our listeners have a wonderful Christmas. Obviously difficult, very difficult times for everybody, but I hope you have the best Christmas you can. And we'll see you for our New Year episode.